Okay, so for the sake of the recording, this I'm going to call Shakyamuni's I and All Beings. So there's the way that I'm starting to think about it is that there's two different kinds of Dharma study. I mean, you can categorize it as two, you could categorize it in many different ways. But there's two different kinds in my mind. One being topics, Dharma talks, classes, books, whatever, that I would say are focused on manifestation and application. So we talk about the tools of our practice, zazen, how to sit zazen, what does that mean? Precept practice, sangha practice, practice in our relationships, mindfulness practice throughout the day. Self-study, exploring the nature of self, our experience, seeing through our delusions, karma work, application. How do we apply practice to the challenges we face in our everyday lives? You know, not just keeping it theoretical, but what are we, how does this relevant to our lives? So most of these topics are obviously very accessible and relevant if you're into Zen. The other kind of Dharma study I'm thinking of at the moment, anyway, as exploring ultimate truth. So, ultimate meaning the last, the furthest, farthest, ending a process or series, the ultimate point in a journey, maximum decisive conclusive, the ultimate authority. So this kind of teaching, this kind of topic is challenging ourselves to keep on opening up to and becoming more familiar with the deeper truths that pervade our life and all existence. So I think the way that I want to teach anyway is to have a good balance of these two kinds of discussions. Some spiritual traditions, some lineages, some teachers, and I think this is particularly common in Rinzai Zen, speak most of the time about the ultimate truth. When you get together, this is a time to reflect on, to encounter, to emphasize awakening to ultimate truth. But sometimes such communities can neglect discussions of, say, moral behavior, precepts, the way truth manifests in everyday life, how to apply the truth to your life in practical ways to make it relevant, or how to make it beneficial to others. But of course, we can also dwell a little bit too much on manifestation and application. That is kind of the most accessible, the most obvious. Like, if I'm going to put the Dharma talk topic in the newsletter, right? And you see it's something like, ways to practice with anger, you go like, yeah, probably a good one for me to go to. But if you see that I'm saying Shakyamuni's I and all beings, like, okay, I don't really know what that is. So it's more obviously accessible, perhaps interesting, or seems more obviously relevant. But if we only talk about that, in a sense that topic of how to apply the truth, how to manifest the Dharma in our lives is endless, right? That gives us plenty of material. We could just deal with that. But in some ways, then we also are sticking to what we know, what we already know, or limiting ourselves only to what's obviously applicable. And avoiding the challenge of teachings that defy our immediate grasp, which are not yet obviously relevant. And I find myself doing this as well. In some ways, it'd be much easier for me to just write a Dharma talk on, like, practice, generosity in relationships, as opposed to what I'm going to talk about today. But let's do it. So in the interest of balance, I'm speaking on the first chapter of Keizan's Denkaroku. So Denkaroku is a book, Transmission of Light is a translation of that title. Keizan Jokin was a Japanese Zen master, lived 1268 to 1325. And he's the fourth generation after Dogen. So Dogen's disciple was Koen Ejo. Koen Ejo, that was Tetsugi Kai, and then they're with Keizan. And Keizan is considered the like second most important or equally important founder of Soto Zen in Japan, Dogen being the first and Keizan being the second. Sometimes Dogen is described as the father of Soto Zen and Keizan is described as the mother. So he's an interesting study all in himself. But he wrote this book, Denkaroku, The Transmission of the Light. And it's a succession of, it's like 50 something stories. Let's see, actually this one's numbered 53. Down from, there's Dogen and Ejo. So it doesn't have Tetsugi Kai, Keizan's teacher. All the way from Buddha. So every ancestor has a chapter. And these are essentially koans, teaching stories. So there's something happening in each story. The very fact that it is, you know, put into a record like this, the very fact that it is taught and shared means something important is going on here that we should pay attention to. But it also means that it's usually, at least initially, baffling at places in terms of what is going on and the descriptions and the images. But we're asked to directly engage with the material, not to intellectualize, not to accrue more concepts, but to challenge the ideas we already have. So I'm going to read much of this chapter today, but I'm actually going to start with a paragraph way up toward the end where Keizan says, because this first chapter is about Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment. So he says, so studying from all angles, penetrating in all ways, you should clarify Buddha's enlightenment and understand your own enlightenment. I want you all to see this story closely and be able to explain it, letting the explanation flow from your own heart, not borrowing the words of another. So some people find it rather surprising that Zen involves so much literature and so many words and so many stories and so many instances where we're invited to kind of delve into what does this mean? What could this mean? When, you know, we're not supposed to be intellectualizing it, right? We're supposed to just be living our lives. But as I'm fond of saying, this is about challenging ideas we already have, assumptions that we just walk around with, we're unaware of until we encounter something that challenges them. So one of the things I do like, there have been some folks in the Sangha interested in koans, and which in Soto Zen, we don't use as a formal system of study, as in I'm going to assign you that and then you pass it and you go on to another one. But we have plenty of koans in our teaching literature. And one of the things I do like about Denkaroku, I feel like of the koan collections, it's fairly accessible, if only because the chapters aren't all that long. I was sort of looking at like Book of Serenity or something like that. And it's like the chapters go on and on and on. And there's like this Zen master then comments on what that Zen master said. And then they're bringing in all kinds of new stories with new images. And it can be a little overwhelming. But Keizan tends to keep it a little simpler. There's the story around the ancestor and then some commentary, but then he moves on. So some of you will have be familiar with this. Shakyamuni Buddha realized enlightenment on seeing the morning star. He said, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. Shakyamuni left his palace one night when he was 19 years old and shaved off his hair. After that, he spent 6 years practicing ascetic exercises. Subsequently, he sat on an indestructible seat, so immobile that there were cobwebs in his brows, a bird's nest on his head, and reeds growing up through his mat. Thus, he sat for 6 years. In his 30th year, on the 8th day of the 12th month, he was suddenly enlightened when the morning star appeared. Then he spoke the foregoing words, his first lion's roar. After that, he spent 49 years helping others by teaching, never staying in seclusion. With just one robe and one bowl, he lacked nothing. He taught at over 360 assemblies, and then finally entrusted the treasury of the Eye of Truth to Kashyapa, and its transmission has continued to the present. Indeed, this is the root of the transmission and practice of the true teaching in India, China, and Japan, and now America and the West. The behavior of Shakyamuni Buddha during his lifetime is a model for the disciples he left behind. Even though he may have had the 32 special marks of greatness and the 80 kinds of refinements, he kept the form of an old mendicant, no different from anyone else. Therefore, ever since he was in the world, through the three periods of his teaching, those who have sought the way of his teaching have imitated the Buddha's form and manners, have used the endowment of the Buddha, and in all their doings have always considered the task of self-understanding foremost. Having transmitted from Buddha to Buddha, from adept to adept, the true teaching has never been cut off. This story clearly points to this. So now it's going to get wacky, but let's just pause there for a moment. That was pretty straightforward storytelling. I recently did a podcast episode on the Zen Studies podcast about the Buddha's life story as archetype and teaching. So in some ways, even though it's the next part of the commentary, which is going to get into this thing that Buddha said, I am enlightened with all beings. I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time, which is kind of a strange statement. But even this relatively straightforward story of his life is significant, a significant teaching with much for us to explore, because it includes Prince Siddhartha's Samvega, his sense of there must be something more, and his search, his spiritual search. The message that a search is worth it, that there is something worth seeking. And the fact that Shakyamuni is not remarkable because he awakened. He's remarkable because he left a path of practice for others to follow. And they can similarly awaken. So it arouses questions for us. This is what a koan is supposed to do. What are we seeking? Why are you here today? Why do you spend time sitting? Why do you spend time practicing Zen? What brings us to seek? What is awakening? Do we even believe in it? But now let's continue. So he had said, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. Even though what the Buddha pointed out and explained in the more than 360 meetings over 49 years was not the same, The various stories, parables, metaphors, and explanations did not go beyond the principle illustrated in the story of his enlightenment. Whatever is here is like the essence, right? This is the essence. That is to say, I, exclamation mark, I is not Shakyamuni Buddha. Even Shakyamuni Buddha comes from this I. And it does not only give birth to Shakyamuni Buddha. All beings on earth also come from here. Just as when you lift up a net, all the holes are raised. In the same way, when Shakyamuni Buddha was enlightened, so too were all beings on earth enlightened. And it was not only all beings on earth that were enlightened. All the Buddhas of past, present, and future also attained enlightenment. While this is so, do not think of Shakyamuni Buddha as having become enlightened. Do not see Shakyamuni Buddha outside of all beings on earth. However immensely diverse the mountains, rivers, land, and all forms and appearances may be, all of them are in the eye of the Buddha. And you too are standing in the eye of the Buddha. And it is not simply that you are standing there. The eye has become you. Buddha's eye has become everybody's whole body, each standing tall. Therefore, this clear, bright eye that spans all time should not be thought of as the people evidently here. You are Buddha's eye. Buddha is your whole body. This being so, what do you call the principle of enlightenment? I ask you, is the Buddha enlightened with you? Are you enlightened with the Buddha? If you say you become enlightened with the Buddha, or you say the Buddha becomes enlightened with you, this is not the Buddha's enlightenment at all. Therefore, it should not be called the principle of enlightenment. Even so, I and together, I neither one nor two. Your skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are all together. And the host inside the house is I. It does not have skin, flesh, bones, or marrow. It does not have gross physical or mental elements. Ultimately speaking, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, how could it be apart from this skin bag? So that's a reference to another image, the idea of the hut being our body and mind, this physical manifestation that we have, and the undying person in the hut being our true nature, our something. What is it? What is this self? What is this being? So you should not understand the beings on earth as distinct from yourself. So let's become conscious of how we naturally think about Shakyamuni Buddha, about ourselves, about enlightenment. We think Shakyamuni was a person who may or may not have existed. Let's say he did exist. He did spiritual practice. I mean, described it earlier in this story. He was really good at it. And at some point he had a profound realization, or maybe he had lots of smaller realizations, however it happened. And at some point he realized stuff you and I can't even imagine. And he created this path for us to follow. He taught others, just as the story went, and then he taught others, and now it's come to us, and this is a practice that we do. And if we do it, we might realize what Shakyamuni did, maybe, if we try really hard. Or maybe you don't even really care about realizing what Shakyamuni did. Maybe it's good enough, the manifestation and application. Reduce some stress, be a kinder person. You know, maybe some idea of enlightenment is not really even where it is for you. And it's not a bad thing to think this way. Any piece of Zen is useful. But if we want to challenge ourselves to explore ultimate truth, to keep growing, we should examine what Kazan is saying. So in our scenario, our natural, like, logical scenario, enlightenment is an experience an individual has at some point in time. There's before, when they were deluded and experiencing dukkha, and then afterwards, where they become conscious of their insight and see reality with a capital R, as I've talked about it, and they experience spiritual liberation. And if I experience enlightenment, I can't give it to you. You have to practice yourself. You have to realize it yourself. Shakyamuni left us a path, but each of us has to follow it. And all of this is true. All of this at a certain level is true. What Kazan is pointing to does not nullify or make that untrue. But there's something else going on as well. Enlightenment is not what we think it is. Self is not what we think it is. Time is not what we think it is. Realizing all of this is enlightenment. The koan language teachings about ultimate truth will not be immediately accessible or understandable. They just, if they were, we would just stay in our usual frame of mind. So it's often poetic, befuddling, but it's pointing towards something beyond or beneath the obvious. So what is the meaning of Shakyamuni's words? I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. I mean, maybe he's saying, because he discovered a path of enlightenment and it's accessible to anyone, and generally everybody kind of moves toward learning, then eventually everybody can become enlightened. So in a sense, as he achieved enlightenment, everybody else is liberated too. And that's true in a sense, but that's not what we're getting at. What kind of thing can we share with all beings on earth? We know there's something, or we know there are infinitely many things. And yet, as soon as we define those things, they become limited. We might think, oh, well, we all share awareness. And yet, Kazan speaks, as Dogen did many times, of other kinds of manifestations sharing in whatever this is. However immensely diverse the mountains, rivers, land, and all forms and appearances may be, all of them are in the eye of the Buddha. Okay, so it's not awareness. When we try to imagine what we might share with all beings, we're still thinking of an I who is separate from all beings, from Buddha. So as I've done before, I find it helpful to think of kind of dreaming my way into this imagery. I say, like, I is not Shakyamuni. Even he comes from this I. I gives birth to all beings on earth. So imagine you're dreaming, and this is the case, right? And later on, you'll describe it, right? And in retrospect, you'll realize it sounds strange, and how could it be? And it doesn't really make any sense. But while you were in the dream, it made perfect sense, right? Like, I met Shakyamuni, and I had realized everything he had realized, and I understood that, like, every being and everything shared the same nature, but not really like sharing a nature, like we each have a piece of it, but like we're all part of one organism. I'm not exactly. That was kind of, it's kind of like some vast organism. It's not, there's not some vast organism that you could point to that was separate from me and Buddha. It's more like what was ever was animating me was fundamentally no different from what was animating you. Anyway, it was really cool. I had this sense of connection or non-separateness, even while I still had my individuality. I find it, you know, kind of easier to just imagine myself in a dream world where like completely different rules apply, right? It's kind of a exercise for the imagination. A lot of this, I think, speaks to our natural desire as human beings that I find fascinating. We want to be one. We want to be non-separate. We want to belong. We want to return, to be connected, to be redeemed, to be part of something greater. But we also want to be individuals. We also want to be ourselves. We also want to be autonomous. We also want to experience our lives. And these can sometimes seem to be incompatible. And at times, maybe we're practicing Zen really hard. Maybe we're meditating really hard, right? Or maybe we take drugs or whatever, but we're trying to like merge back into the one, you know, like to shed this sense of separateness, shed this sense of I in order to, you know, partake of Shakyamuni's enlightenment. It was said to allow the Buddha's I to become us. Drop the differentiations. As Keizan says, even together is or one still implies that there's like separate things that are all one. Your skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are all together. And the host inside the house is I. It does not have skin, flesh, bones, or marrow. It does not have gross physical or mental elements. Ultimately speaking, if you want to know the undying person in the hut, how could it be apart from this skin bag? The skin bag, the hut, being our five skandhas, the body, sensations, perceptions, including our mind and our thoughts. The undying person in the hut, what is that? All of these other things end, they die. So is the undying person in the hut a soul, an essence, which survives the death of the body, which most religions say exist, but not Buddhism? But it actually said that doesn't exist. So what are we talking about then? All of the things change. The hut is ephemeral. What is our true self nature? Who are we? We know we are alive. We know we are. How do we know that? If there was no one here, there would be no Buddhist practice, and yet this one cannot be grasped. There's no inherent essence. Does this mean we don't exist? All of these questions are based on assumptions we don't even realize we're making until we become more familiar with ultimate truth. How could it be apart from this skin bag? This flesh here and now, this manifestation, my life, your life, exactly as it is. All of these details, which we're usually so wrapped up in and attached to, are not it. Not it in the sense of an essence of self, of executive I, all these things which we question and try to see through. And yet this is it. It cannot be found anywhere else. Your life, my life, just as it is, manifests what Shakyamuni realized perfectly. We can't imagine that this can be so, that just this is it, this is perfect manifestation. And that's why we're not enlightened. Because we can't imagine that. We're still bounded by the limits of our imagination. But then even when we come to know this undying person in the hut, we should not understand the beings on earth as distinct from yourself. So how is this possible to have some kind of real, true self nature upon which we can rely and there being no distinction between us and everything else? And this is what this koan is pointing toward, amongst other things. I'm not saying it's the only thing it's pointing toward, but a very key question of our existence. And that, ironically, that sense of returning to one's true self nature is, you know, it doesn't make any sense intellectually when, like, all right, all the skandhas are ephemeral, there's no inherent essence, then what? But what I find very, very striking, I can't remember where this is from. This is some, I could look it up if anybody's interested, but it's a koan story and a Zen master who got in the habit of periodically throughout the day, he'd just call out to himself and then answer. So if I was to do this, just kind of randomly as I'm driving home, Domio, yeah, just what? And if you try to do that, it's very interesting. If you call out to yourself and you have a sense like, yeah, I know who I am. Yes. Chances are that is based on conditional things. Chances are that is based on, you know, a view of yourself, which may seem fairly stable, but at some point could start to fall apart. And then that's very unnerving. If you're anything like me as well, I might call up and be like, is that my real self? I don't know. Is that my real self answer? What would be a completely authentic response? A totally free, spontaneous, yes, I don't pause to look somewhere else. I don't pause to doubt. I don't pause to wonder. Maybe there's something else. Maybe there's some essence. Maybe there's somebody better. Yes, here I am. So we only imagine this to be a problem. This whole, like, how can I be, you know, not this kind of, how can I be the Buddha's body? How can I not be distinct from all beings on earth and yet still have this essential self? It's not actually a problem. We just, within our usual framework, it seems like a problem. Buddha is your whole body. Buddha is an awakened being. What does it mean that an awakened being is your whole body? Do you have a sense of this? Sometimes when you look down at your hand, when you really look at it, do you have a sense of this? That is just what is, but also somehow more than that. That somehow, like, the mysteries of the universe are actually manifested there. Manifested through it, with it, because of it. So I'm more or less going to leave it there. And we have 15 minutes, but this, I was thinking this kind of this kind of talk doesn't lend itself to, you know, the usual kind of Q&A, at least not if we're going to avoid, you know, just intellectualizing it. So in some ways, I have no idea how this is going to work, but I invite you to respond more with the spirit of improv. Artistic response, poetic response, dream imagery response. Trying to set aside the intellect and direct explanation as much as possible. You know, we want to distill this down. Like I said, what is this koan about? What did it mean that he said, I and all beings? Okay, well, that meant, you know, like we can explain it. But we can know it. We can play around with it. We can convey it. We can get a little bit of a sense of it. Setting aside questions of manifestation and application, how is this relevant to my life? What does this mean to my relationship with my husband? You know, how do I act like this? It's like just kind of setting those concerns aside and just playing with this imagery. But at the same time, we do wrestle with language. There's even though all of this is beyond language, I heard another definition of koan, I'll have to look it up, but it's essentially the way of the word. Koans put this into language. The whole point is to wrestle with the language, to explore the language. What might this mean? What does this feel like? What does this invoke? So we are invited. I don't know. It's hard to describe. What's the difference between intellectualizing, you know, what's the Buddha's body versus kind of exploring it? So maybe it's that more of a kind of a playful attitude, right? When we're trying to explain, we're trying to like pin it down, you know, we're trying to like, okay, I got it. As opposed to kind of talking about it and realizing, yeah, I'm gonna get it. I'm not gonna get it, but I can respond to it. We can point to it. Two of us can do a little harmony and like, oh yeah. So I don't know if that leaves everybody completely silent or just, or if you're willing to come on up. All right, Dave.
I like it, bro.
All right.
So I and all beings, I mean, of course, right? How could it be different? Was there a different alternative to begin with?
Yes. What does that mean? What does it mean to be enlightened all by yourself? That's the question that arises in my mind. James.
I don't know if we're having a dialogue or we're just going for it. Right?
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that about playing, because that my recent experience with when we were at Sesshin and I did the directed practice of the most root koan, the, you know, who is this sitting here, and that temptation to look for an answer and to avoid the temptation to try to find an answer to that question and to just, you know, am I the tree, am I the bird, yes, no, and that exercise is exhausting all the possibilities, and that point where you finally reach the point where there is no answer to find to begin with, but that's kind of the essence of it, maybe to a degree. So I think that's our natural tendency is to try to always find that intellectual answer for everything. And the exact action of avoiding that is practice. I don't know. That didn't, it's case 12 in the Lumenkan Zuigan call strips.
Okay, yeah. Good. I know where it is now. And also that's where koans come alive, not just the formal teaching stories, but also in our own lives, the koans that arise naturally in daily life. it's we care about them. We have to find within the story or the issue something that we really care about. And I think that's like kind of the difference between the intellectualizing, which might just be like, well, you know, like I'm speaking about it in the abstract, as opposed to, you know, so say, well, what does it mean that the Buddha would be your whole body? I mean, it could mean that, you know, enlightenment is an essence that pervades the universe and it's, you know, kind of in between the atoms. And, you know, like you could come up with some explanation, right? But like, I think like, what does it mean that the Buddha is my body? There's a part of me that I don't get it, but I love that idea. That would be wonderful. The Buddha is my whole body. My whole body is already awakened. Could that be? And if so, why do I often not feel that way? Like what?
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever I'm faced with this type of absolute reality thinking, I grab for the metaphor. Like I grab for the poetic, I guess, metaphor. And to me, what I was thinking about today while you were explaining this koan is that it's as if the body of the Buddha were like a cloud, and it's less like one cloud, but it's more like it's overcast, right? That kind of cloud body. Mm-hmm. And that each one of us are individual extensions, you know, how the clouds kind of come out different spots. Well, we're coming out in these different spots, and then the nature of reality changing toward leaning toward enlightenment, right, it's like contains within it the Buddha nature, the potential for rain exists. And Shakyamuni having the enlightenment is like a cloud turning from not having potential to rain to being rainy. I know that's very strange. But this is where my mind goes when you try, because it's trying to come to, you know, it's trying to make sense of and imagine the abstraction of these ideas. So thank you.
Well, I've often found that image of a cloud very helpful when I think of like a cloud exists. It does exist. I mean, especially, you know, beautiful cumulus cloud, right? You can look up in the sky and there it is. But if I think of myself as being like a cloud, it's like, well, there's no, I exist, but there's no like fixed boundary. And I might be kind of like, you know, morphing and moving in the wind. And that helps me feel like, yeah, maybe I could exist and yet not be fixated on an essence or something unchanging, you know. Brian.
So Shakyamuni is doing his monk interviews. And this is the one he's dreaded the whole time. It's with his dumbest and laziest monk. And he feels that he may lose his equanimity and set himself back many lifetimes. And so he says, okay, look, you're never going to get it. You're never going to get anything. So I'm going to hit the fast forward button 2,600 years ahead. And I'm going to tell you about your brain. All right. And so the deal is this, that for us to survive, we needed to be able to do stuff, you know, find food, worry about enemies and threats and blah, blah, blah. So we've got this self that does that, takes care of the whole, you know, back. Right? But that's not all there is. Because in addition to kind of steering ourselves around the world, we have to have an awareness of that world. And most of the time, it's functional for us to be selective about that awareness, you know, where are the plants, the tigers, the people, and so forth. But when we lose the self, when it thins, when it it gets drowsy when it recedes. That part of us, then the awareness, the connection to the world and to other people, that suffuses ourselves more than it usually does. Okay, you're done. Out you go. See you next year. So that's my thing. So.
Thank you.
We have the gift of imagination, and we can sit with the koans or whatever legendary images we have, like the lesson of the hut, because words, even culturally, can be traps. So it's just an invitation to the wider possibilities. Thank you for this talk today.
Thank you, Ruthann. Yeah, I think it's like very, you know, it is a lot like poetry sometimes. I think of how, you know, you can read a poem, I mean, or obviously you can listen to music or watch a movie or something, same thing, but poetry seems so pure in this regard where, I mean, it can't, you wouldn't resonate with it if it was completely foreign to your experience. And yet it's possible for it to point you toward something that you've never really actually thought of before. Yeah, that's true. I never looked at it that way. So kind of be like mind expanding. Alice.
Yeah, okay. When you started reading from your book, I thought of, well, okay, what does it mean to be Domio to me? What does it mean to be Erica to me? And frankly, if I didn't exist, neither would you to me. And I wouldn't exist to you if you didn't exist. So it's kind of like there's a we-ness. I'm playing with words now. So if he awakens to the weeness of everything, then if he awakens to the weeness of everything, then if he's awakened, then you're awakened, and so is Erica.
I think it's kind of get back to like Dave's question or statement made me think of like, well, what is the nature of enlightenment? If enlightenment, is it enlightenment if I just have this like really amazing insight that makes me feel better and it doesn't open me up to how I am not separate from anyone or anything? In which case, we're all enlightened together. Let's see, Denny.
Oh, I'm sorry. this is my first time sort of participating, so I'm not sure how I cue you, whether it's raising my
hand. No, raising your hand was perfect.
I just, first of all, wonder if it could have at least something to do with impermanence, because, I mean, when you think about impermanence, anything we observe, touch, feel, is, even our own bodies, is constantly changing. And eventually everything disappears, and whatever it was that made up our bodies is who knows where else. So in that sense, we are all one. We're all part of this big soup that keeps percolating and changing and mixing up. And what I do is I think at the same time of this, what's sometimes called a ground of being, or and I know, Domio, you mentioned that awareness wasn't it. And so I don't know what else to call this. It's kind of like emptiness, which could be awareness and pure potential. There are no dividing lines. There are no separate forms. But there's a potential for anything. And it's just awareness and potential. So I don't know. I just think of it as a combination of materiality, always moving, always changing, always mixing up. But at the same time, we share this ground of being, which I don't know. You could even, some people think of it as the ultimate divine. But anyway, that's what goes through my imagination.
And I think that's why, like, to some extent, the koans with which we resonate may differ by person, you know, depending on the kinds of the way that we relate to the world. And then the key is, like, how do we move from that sense, right? The kind of intuition that, like, there's this ground of being. I don't know, everything's impermanent, but somehow it's kind of okay, or a big bank of clouds. How do we go from that to, like, really seeing how we fit into all of that in a very, very, like, firsthand way? Because some of that, you know, we can be a kind of comforting way to view the world or something like that. But taking that to, you know, something that completely changes the way that we relate to the world and perceive ourselves, allowing that to transform us is where that, like, that's where we're pushing the edge of this imagery and this study, right? Because then, like, essentially the answers, whatever the responses that we've all given today, all of us, if we were doing a koan with a teacher, we'd take it to the teacher and we would say that, and they would say, that is lovely. That's not it.
Yeah.
You know, and then we'd live, oh, all right. And, you know, so it's like we're going to the point where, we recognize it. When we experience and we see it, it's something very directly relevant to us. All right, well, that will wrap it up. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you, Jamil.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.